From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Carol Ann Shaw, whose new book is titled Right After the Weather, published by Atria Books. Carol Ann Shaw is the author of Carrie the One, Aquamarine, Seven Moves, and Lucky in the Corner. She has received the Farrow Grumley Award, the Carl Sandburg Award, and a National Book Critics Circle citation for excellence in reviewing. Carol Ann Shaw's short fiction has been anthologized and published in various periodicals, including VLS, New Ohio Review, and Tin House. Her stories, Hammam, Elvis Has Left the Building, and The Last Speaker of the Language, were chosen for inclusion in Best American Short Stories of 1994, 1998, and 2012, respectively. Carol Ann Shaw is a past fellow of the Illinois Arts Council and the National Endowment for the Arts. She is also a painter. She lives in Chicago and in Amsterdam with her partner, the filmmaker Jesse Ewing. Her new novel, Right After the Weather, brings us to the fall of 2016. Kate, a set designer in her early 40s, lives and works in Chicago's theater community. She has stayed too long at the fair and knows it's time to get past her prolonged adolescence and stop taking handouts from her parents. She has a firm plan to get solvent and settled in a serious relationship. She's tentatively started something new, even as she's haunted by an old going-nowhere affair. Her ex-husband, recently booted from his most recent marriage, is currently camped out in Kate's spare bedroom, enthralled to online conspiracy theories, and she's not sure how to help him. Her best friend Neil, a yoga instructor, lives nearby with her son and is Kate's model for what serious adulthood looks like. Only a few blocks away, but in a parallel universe, we find Nathan and Irene, casual sociopaths, drug addicts, and small-time criminals. Their world and Kate's intersect the day she comes into Neil's kitchen to find these strangers assaulting her friend. Forced to take fast, spontaneous action, Kate does something she's never even considered. She now also knows the violence she is capable of, as does everyone else in her life, and overnight their world has changed. Ann Shaw's flawed, sympathetic, and uncannily familiar characters grapple with their altered relationships and identities against the backdrop of the new Trump presidency and a country waking to a different understanding of itself. When I spoke with Carol Ann Shaw, I began by mentioning that in both this novel, Right After the Weather, and her previous book, Carrie the One, about which I spoke to her in 2011, I believe, the characters' lives are suddenly unbalanced by an unexpected event. I asked if this is how she now opens her narratives. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
You know, I'm working on a new book, and it's not like that at all. So I can't draw a generalization. You know, in both Carrie the One and Right After the Weather, I was looking at what happens after something violent. You know, how it changes people. So for me, writing the book, that provides a lot of interest. You know, that I don't have. You know, Mary Sits in a Chair isn't my book. You know, And also, the internal changes that these shocking events, you know, must occasion. Anyway, it just keeps it interesting for me.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting way to approach the story of people who are sort of like, you know, I think like most of us kind of traveling along and have found our equilibrium. But then if something upends that, it's really interesting to see how people react. And it also gave you a way to look at lots of different kinds of people in this book, people at different points in their life, people at different socioeconomic stages. So we'll get to that. Let's see. There's this point in the book, and let me see if I can find it. There's this point where Kate, your main character, is imagining who would cast. So she enters a mental space she gets to by way of a deep tunnel. Once inside, she can realize a set to its smallest detail. She can see the actors bring the set to life. Sometimes she casts the play with perfect actors. I wondered if you ever do that with your novels. Do you ever figure out who would play what part?
Once in a while.
Yeah. Have any of your books been made into movies or TV shows or anything?
No.
Have they ever been optioned or anything like that?
And then nothing ever happens. You know, they pay $1,000 and then a year later they drop it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. That's where I don't know what to wish for, you know, because I have friends whose books were made into movies and the movies were terrible. And then they, you know, had that. And then, at least if they stay books, they stay mine.
Right. Yeah. And then there's actually another part of this book where Kate, I'm not going to go into details because I don't like giving away anything, but she gets a pretty great opportunity professionally, and she starts imagining her future greatness. And I think that's like something that we can all sort of fall into. It's this setup for, I don't know, like, or maybe it's actually an opportunity because it helps us keep with our craft, particularly artists. It's so hard to make a living, and so you can sort of imagine future greatness. Do you agree that's kind of a typical or a common scenario for artists?
You know, I wonder if it is, though. I don't know. That doesn't, mostly I hope to get something done well. And like with this book, it was terribly difficult to write. It was really the hardest book. I realized when I was working on it that I had used little tricks, you know, like Aquamarine was really three little novellas. Then I could change the characters and carry the one. I could switch from character to character and move them forward in time. So I never had to do anything with a long run. And then with this book, I had a real tight timeline, and I had to stay where I was, and I had these very, you know, I had these kind of oppositional sets of characters. And so I had to balance, you know, if I was going to be funny in one place, then is it too shocking to be horrible in the very next place? A lot of tone adjustments and stuff like that. So I guess this is a long way around to saying my goal was not to appear on The View or whatever, but was to make this book, to make it work.
Yeah, okay. Carol, do you have a theater background at all?
No.
Okay. Because I should mention that that's a part of this book that was really fun for me to read about was Kate does set design. That's her work. And so there's a lot about the theater in the book. And I have just finished a novel where the protagonist is a lighting designer. So that was kind of fun to read about. And I'm not in the theater either, but it's just fun. So.
I had to do a ton of research, but I hope, you know, people don't say, oh, no, that's nothing like what it's like. But I did the best I could.
Oh, it seemed very realistic to me. I did a lot of theater earlier in my life. It sounded quite real to me. I loved how being a set designer, Kate is, I love the way that she notices things, notices settings. She's very specific in, like, outdoors, the beach and the woods and things like that, the street. But that's, you know, sort of what all of us do. But in people's apartments, seeing the, like, noticing objects in people's apartments is just so perfect to her profession. I really enjoyed that. And also sometimes she's imagining what the apartment is of a certain person she's just met, but she's imagining the objects that they have in their the place they live, and what do the curtains look like, and what does the furniture look like. And that was so great for her job.
And she's a total snob, you know. She's a total snob. She's always, demeaning someone's decor.
Yeah. That's true. Early in the book, she's scouting for a piece of furniture. She's looking for an old desk that would be right for the period of a play she's working on. And she finds this perfect desk. And in the drawer, there are these two lovely old fountain pens. And She doesn't steal them. You know, I mean, it would be really easy to just walk out the door with them, but she does not do that. She, you know, she thinks to herself, okay, I'm going to ask these guys, when I tell them I'm buying the desk, I'm going to ask them if I can keep these pens. And I just thought that was just a wonderful, really subtle way to show something about her character, something important about her character, especially because not everybody around her is that honest. So up against that, it makes a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, no, she's very principled.
Yes, yeah.
And that's why this kind of morally shabby girlfriend to play off of.
Right. It was fun. That was, and we haven't met the girlfriend at the point that Kate decides she's going to ask if she can have the pens. So that is already in our minds as readers that she is, an ethical person before we meet her girlfriend. And then another character that I loved just absolutely and totally was Sailor, the dog. This dog is sort of saving her, I think, little by little throughout the book at different points. And I loved, and it's really funny, every book should have a dog character. I loved this line, Sailor thinks he's going with them, which he is not. It's like, I just could picture this dog getting all excited because something's about to happen. And anyway, sorry, I love dogs. So do you want to talk about how you put, I mean, I feel like the dog had a real role to play in this book. He was not just an accessory in the scenes.
No, he's a character.
Yeah.
Well, the dogs really are characters, and they're emotional characters too. So I had an emotional book, so I needed someone to try to protect her emotionally.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot in this book that's just really, really funny. I love the banter between Kate and her best friend from childhood, really, Neil. Kate's funny anyway. Like, I find her all the way through to have a very kind of just, I was laughing out loud at some of her observations of the world. But their long friendship is really evident in the banter between them, and I enjoyed that. And I wondered if, when you're writing a friendship like that, are you just kind of inventing it, or are you thinking of somebody in your own life and kind of riffing off of that, or how does that work for you?
No, pure invention.
Pure invention.
It would be too hard the other way, trying to match up to real people.
Yeah. Can you talk a little more about that, why it's hard?
I create a whole fictional world, and then I populate it, and then I give it furniture, and then I give it a dog, and then I make that dog almost a human character. And so all of that fits into a box, a little box, like a Cornell box. And it would be way more difficult to pull in pieces from real life. It's best to keep the box and create inside it and go back to it. It's still there, all that stuff I made up.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I agree completely that it can be really like, taking a real person and trying to create that on the page I feel like it's just a waste of time because you're never going to make the person who you're trying to, you're never going to be able to convey an entire human being exactly as is. Or the other thing is, I think sometimes if we try, we leave things out because it's all assumed by us. We know the person, and so we're sort of forgetting to present them fully, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's see. I love how you have Kate describe herself, and I think this can be a really hard thing to do I think it's a close third narrative point of view. And so having the character describe herself can sometimes feel a little forced, but you do it really well. You bring us into it by way of her girlfriend Maureen's observation that maybe Kate is too good looking for her. But then immediately she plucks a hair from the cuff of Kate's jacket, which is just this very subtle gesture that almost denies her own compliment, you know, and I loved that. And then the narrative goes on. Kate, by her own standards, isn't all that attractive. She's awkward, gangly with her height, as though she's still adjusting to it. Maybe she has something small going for her, a serious expression, like that of a reporter in a war zone or a doctor about to give bad news, a face that is flat planes and abrupt angles. She also got her father's ice blue eyes, which adds another element to the chill. She does know this severity holds value in particular situations, incipient romance being one. So, I mean, that's actually a pretty long descriptive passage, but it's brought into so naturally by Maureen's comment that it works really, really well. And then we do have a sense of what Kate looks like.
You don't want the character walking past the mirror.
Right.
Know? That would be what I would tell students if there was ever a mirror in a passage. I said, get that mirror out of there, you know?
Right. It's too obvious. It's too easy. Or it's too set up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, so we should talk more about Maureen. So Kate's in a relatively new relationship, and they're very drawn to one another, but they're very different people. And I don't know, these small differences eventually begin to kind of like imply larger conflict down the road. And I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about small conflict. You know, I mean, as we mentioned, this book has a very big event that's incredibly important to all these characters. But I think small conflicts are really important, too. And I just wonder if we can talk about that a little bit.
With Maureen, I just wanted one small event after another to make it clear that she's, you know, not right for Kate. But on the way in, you're always hoping, you know, you've got your hopes. And I remember being with this woman on her sofa, and I looked over her shoulder, and there were six books on her shelf, six, and they were like six terrible books, and she probably hadn't even read them. Got them at a resort town, and I thought, wow, this is going to be tough going here. So you, the kinds of small things you look at to pull back the curtain on somebody, that's what I have her doing with Maureen.
Yeah, and it's, Maureen is an attractive person in a lot of ways. I don't just mean physically, but she's, you know, she's got her attributes and she is trying and she really wants to be in this relationship and she's not altogether a bad person. So in a way, that's even more interesting because it takes longer and longer to figure out whether or not this is going to work.
Yeah.
Now we have a secondary narrative. You do have I think you have more than one narrative point of view, but it's mostly Kate. But then there's also this other presentation of narrative, which is almost more of a journal format. And it's by a character called Nathan. And I wonder if you can talk about writing those sections a little bit.
It was totally easy. It's scary to say. Cause
really?
Yeah. I wrote those right away, I think, and I hardly changed them at all as I went along with the book. I don't know what dark patch of my soul that they came from, but yeah.
Yeah, and now we should mention that Nathan is he's a dark character. He's pretty twisted, and he and his friend Irene get into very terrible crimes. Some of them are just theft, and some of them are damaging people's homes or possessions, and then he also rapes women. So I wonder, as you wrote these little narrative pieces, did you already know at that, like you say you wrote them early on, did you kind of know what the arc of the book was at that point?
Yes.
Yeah. So the book does have some violence in it, in a very specific scene, and then later in memories of that same scene. And I wonder if you can talk separately now about the experience of writing violence and accessing disturbing material.
I'm not sure I know what to say about that. I and Carrie, the one, I also had a violent event, a car crash.
Yeah.
In this book, I had to show, in some way, the violence because it had to be pretty dramatic for what it made her do, that it made her violent also.
Right.
And so I don't know what to say about how I accessed that. I just imagined it.
I think it's related to what you were already saying about how it's a little disturbing that Nathan came so easily to you. But I do think that we all live in a culture in which violence is sort of a known quantity, if not personally a known quantity. And so to be able to write about it might also be kind of disturbing. Although I do think that as a creative person and trying to, as you said earlier, make a book that's the best that it can be, you have to do it fully and well. And I think you did. But I also think, you know, I imagine you needed to take a break and walk away from some of this sometimes. Is that possibly true?
Well, I did write them fairly quickly. I set them in place and then I wrote the book, the real book around them. So, you know, I just really had a very small, you know, thing to accomplish with those But I love doing it because I thought it served so perfectly as a counterpoint to people who are living a small, upstanding life, you know. I knew I was on the right track.
Yeah. Now, that leads into my next question, which is, you know, I feel like it was important to you to present people who are living lots of different kinds of lives. You know, for example, Kate doesn't have a lot of money. She's really just staying in her apartment and being able to make her way thanks to the work that she does, but also the generosity or, I don't know, gifts of others. And then you have characters that have quite a lot of money. You have characters like Nathan who have no luck and live in poverty and use drugs to find anything like joy. And so I wondered if that was part of what you were trying to get to as you wrote the book, was sort of the many lives that people lead around each other and make our way past each other, and how that connection ultimately can be really, I don't know, difficult, but or violent, but I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I love writing novels, and one of the reasons I love them is because there's several stories in a novel. It's not just, you know, one through line, you know. And yeah, so yeah, actually, every character in this book has a different life. I mean, they're not so different from each other as they are from Nathan and Irene, the miscreants. But they are all different, one from another. And like when you were saying, did I model things after people I knew? No, the fun for me is in making them up and then putting them vis-a-vis each other. And it can be maddening trying to do it, but it's really fun also.
Now, I felt when you were presenting Nathan's point of view through these other narrative entries, I don't know if there's something wrong with me or if you did this on purpose, but I did sort of occasionally enter into these moments of empathy for him, and I wondered if you wanted that.
Well, I don't know about empathy.
Well, maybe empathy is the wrong word, but sort of feeling, first of all, he is literate. He read to me like somebody who had had some sort of an education at some point in time. He has some self-awareness, although he doesn't have any empathy, it seems. But his circumstances aren't where he'd like to be, and he says he has no luck. And maybe that's the point at which I started to feel like, am I starting to try to understand him, or should I just not worry about him? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think that's also an excuse. You know, he had no luck. Other people have luck. Well, you know, other people have troubles also, and they don't go around, you know, raping women or, you know, banging people on the head or whatever he does, you know.
Right.
So I was trying to imagine a thoroughgoing bad guy, but how he justifies himself is that I didn't get any breaks, you know, I got to make my own breaks. And I think that a lot of people tell themselves that who are utterly not thriving in this world.
It's funny, I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I had some curiosity about his circumstances.
Yeah, you're just kind-hearted.
Let's see. I was wondering, I love this actually. So when I first got the copy of the book in the mail, I was wondering why the title was Right After the Weather instead of just After the Weather. And then I came across this sentence in the book. Do you mind if I read it?
No, go ahead.
Kate turns back to look hard at the horizon where the lake is steaming up a little, the last of the recent rain lifting off. She hates how much she feels exactly now when she would have hoped to feel nothing. And that there's emotional context to that passage, which I won't get into, but just the strong emotions she has in that moment and the way she's linking it to weather, and that word exactly felt a lot like the right in the title. And I was like, oh, I love it when, as a reader, I come to something like that and it all starts to make sense to me.
I didn't even think of that line. I wrote right after the weather. There's a line in the book right after the weather.
Oh, I missed it.
Yeah, that's what the title is about. She's in the car, and she's about to. She's kind of anxious because Neil hasn't come down the back steps, and she says, and on the radio, the announcer says, "New Nico Case song, right after the weather."
Oh,
and,
right.
And so she thinks, oh, yeah, I hope I can get Neil going and get back in time. I love Nico Case, and I hope I can get back to hear that song. But the fact is, there's no right after the weather for her. Her life changes forever in the next couple
of
minutes.
Of course. And it's funny because as I approached that, so that's right before a very important scene, and I knew it was coming. And as I approached that scene, I don't think I was reading very closely.
That's where it comes from. Yeah, right after the weather.
Oh, right after the weather on the radio. I'm going to have to look at that again. That's wonderful. So let's see. Oh, yeah. In an interview for Readers, you know, like the Readers interview at the back of the novel of Carrie the One, your last book, you said your next one would be called The Map of a Loud Wandering. Is that this?
Yeah, it is.
That's this book.
That's my first title, yeah. It was a map that I found online, and it was showing a place in England where children could, how far they could go on their own, and then in the next generation, how that narrowed, and then in the next generation, they could only go as far as their front yard. And I remember that in my own childhood, that we would be out all day and wandering very far. And so I thought of it in terms of, you know, different populations living in the city, the circumference of travel kind of narrows down. And then I abandoned that title. I don't think I've ever used my first title in a book. But here in front of my house a couple of weeks ago, my friend Bob was mugged, and he was walking my dog at the time. He lives a couple doors down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the guy had a gun, and he said, "I'm going to kill you and the dog if you, you know, don't give me all your money." And I have to say that this mugger has a terrible business model because, you know, what people walking their dog are going to have a ton of money on them. They're not going to have anything. They're going to have a poop bag. That's it, you know. So he didn't kill him, but I thought, geez, this right in front of my house, so... The Map of a Loud Wandering is closing in on me, you know.
I like that title now that you've explained it, although when I was thinking earlier without context which one I liked better, I liked Right After the Weather better. But, of course, you haven't included all of that in the book anymore, so. But that's interesting. Let's see. Is your friend Bob okay? Was he hurt?
He's fine, yeah. And my dog is fine. And my dog was of no help whatsoever. I guess he was looking for a treat from this guy. Yeah. Some people came around the corner and scared him off.
Okay, so let's see. Just wonderful observations in the book of small moments that kind of indicate large changes in culture. And there's this one, if you don't mind if I read it, there's this one great one. So Kate had been married to a man many years earlier, Graham, and he's a great character in this book as well. And they had this simple wedding, which compared to some of the more ornate affairs she sees discussed on TV shows, it is just like so, like a different time and place, obviously. So this is from your narrative. They had the ceremony in a friend's apartment. She wore a sundress from The Gap. He wore jeans and a thrift shop dinner jacket. Someone took pictures, but she doesn't know where they have drifted off to. Pictures weren't so important then. They weren't so much a validation of experience. Back then, you had experience. Later on, memories. Then you came across a small pile of old snapshots in the back of a drawer and thought how skinny everyone was back then. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's like, it's just like a fun moment, and it made me smile. But at the same time, it's like everything has changed so much. And the importance now of pictures to people and people taking their own pictures, that would have been, first of all, hard to do. But secondly, just kind of unheard of from a point of narcissism back in the 70s, you know. I loved that.
Actually, I remember the wedding that I modeled that on. I remember going to a wedding in the maybe mid-70s, and she wore a sundress and he wore jeans and a white shirt, and you know, it was in somebody's fancy apartment that they knew. And yeah, I just thought it was, you know, It was real cool. I go to weddings infrequently, but I do still go to them, and they seem kind of formulated, you know, by the wedding planner or the event hall or whatever, and you take, you know, whatever they offer, the photo booth, the this, that, you know, but it's all kind of pre-formatted. Well, back in those days, it wasn't so formatted, you know, you could, and it wasn't so necessary that you have a big wedding, you know.
Right, although before that, there were a lot of big weddings, you know, like in the 50s, I'm sure the big weddings were the thing then, too. Certainly the pictures of my parents' wedding and my husband's parents' wedding all look very ornate, and so I guess it kind of swings.
Yeah.
Let's see. One thing that I thought was so telling, you know, part of what I was trying to do as I read the book was think about who Maureen is and whether she and Kate can work things out or not. And then Kate's friend Neil mentions that Maureen is apolitical, and I realized, boom, that is it. That would be it for me. And that's a really interesting observation. You know, can you be with someone apolitical? I mean, it's one thing to be with someone who's politically engaged and disagrees with you, which would be hard for me too. But somebody who's completely apolitical, that would be so hard. I have old friendships that matter to me, and yet I find myself unable to, you know, engage with some of them because they are not paying attention, and that just drives me nuts. I don't think I have a question. I just was mentioning that. let's see. I like to ask guests what they've been reading lately that they've enjoyed and might recommend to listeners.
Yeah, I've just, this is a book that's coming out after mine on swift horses. It's called by Shannon Puffall, Puffahl. It's so great. I can't tell you. It's just so beautifully written.
Okay.
Yeah, no, what a terrific book. I'm always looking for terrific books and so seldom finding them. You know, I'm just always on the search for. And I read back too, you know.
Right.
If my agent sends it to me, it's usually wonderful. She's very, very fussy, and she sent me a book called Preparation for the Next Life by Atticus Lish. She sent me that a couple of years ago. I thought this book just blows my mind. I always trust her. I still, a childhood habit, go to the library and, you know, peruse the new fiction shelves and see who's there. And that's just a habit from when I was a kid.
Let's see. Now, I saw in your bio that you've won a number of different awards and distinctions, but one that I wanted to ask you about was the National Book Critics Circle Citation for Excellence in Reviewing.
That's a long title.
Do you still do book reviews?
No, I don't. I guess, I mean, you know, people have asked, and I did a few around Carry the One for the New York Times, but then they didn't ask me again, so I don't know, I might have flunked that. But I have done so many book reviews in my life that, you know, it makes me wonder how people like, you know, Michiko Kakutani, and when she retired from book review, I thought, of course she's retiring, because it's a very limited form. You know, it's 800 words or at the most 1,200 words, and, you know, it's, I don't know, it's hard to not let it become formulaic for you. And then you run into the problem of you're reviewing other novelists and you feel bad for them if their book is bad, you know, and blah, blah, blah. So I would if the right opportunity came along, but I'd be also happy to never do another book review, you know. I mean, and I stopped teaching a couple of years ago, so my life has changed so significantly because like 80% of my reading for 25 years was student work.
Oh.
Which is, when you're teaching the novel, that's really long.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and
plus it leaves less time for reading anything that you want to read outside of that.
Exactly. That's the problem. So now I can actually read, you know, fiction. I can read fiction for my own fiction to see, you know, I'm having somebody who's a literary scholar in this new book, and I can, you know, I can read up on obscure 20th, early 20th-century writers and stuff like that. And before, I just wouldn't have had the time to do it. So, yeah, what a pleasurable life I have. I write, I read, I paint.
That's wonderful.
I swim.
I love your paintings also. You've got one on your homepage that it must be a self-portrait of you as a child. Is that what it is? That's fantastic. I just love, are those oils? What do you use?
Oil. Yeah, I do.
I mean, I'm not at all an art critic, so I'll embarrass myself if I say anything very specific, but I just think that they are this incredible, like you convey a lot of characteristic without it being a delicate line. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. So you don't want to get exactly the photograph because you already have the photograph. So, let me backtrack a little with you and say that in answering your questions about writing and about writing this book in particular, when I have a friend who's a poet, and she once said to me, when you start writing every day, do you use a prompt? And I said, oh man, you so don't get what I do, you know, which is, I mean, maybe she's writing a poem about a tea kettle or something, but you know, that's never going to be me. So I'm always, I mean, some of your questions implied a kind of subjectivity to the material or to the character or whatever. But for me, I'm bringing from the outside. I'm running this circus, you know. I'm running it, and I'm not subjective to it at all. I don't sit there and cry boo-hoo when something sad happens, you know. I want the reader to cry boo-hoo when that something happens. So everything is on that plan for me to harness all this machinery and these people and make it work. That's my job.
What about when you're finished? That's interesting. And actually I can totally see that as your approach, but when you're finished, let's say you're doing a reading, will it catch up to you? Will the emotional content ever affect you like it might a reader?
Maybe. I guess I'll have to see if I give a reading, if anything happens that way.
Okay. Yeah.
That's how I work.
Now, I just have a couple last questions for you, Carol. I always sort of close out with a question about advice for writers. And in the case of our conversation, I wanted to ask you for some advice for writing the aftermath of a traumatic event. And I guess I'm specifically thinking about the way that you are so good at showing kind of a slower unfurling of fallout after a traumatic event. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but it does seem to be what you've done so very well in the last two novels. But it just, if somebody's working on something traumatic, do you have any advice for how they approach it?
I think in both cases, there was immediate aftermath, and then there was, you know, like the people who were in Nagasaki, you know, those people. And then there's the people who were, you know, way away in another city in Japan, and how it affected them. I guess I would say it's like that, you know, that someone majorly disrupted in the moment. You know, and then go to the people a little further down, what it's like for the people who are the same people, but a little further down in time, and how they would do that.
Yeah, there was an interesting dynamic in this book, and that is the person who experiences violence initially has a son, and he wasn't there for this event. And so it's interesting to see him react to it because he's kind of he's at a remove from the event itself. And so there's, you know, definite emotional, he's going through stuff about not having been there, maybe because he wasn't the one to help, or maybe because he's, you know, traumatized by thinking about it and not having the experience of it. I don't know, but that was interesting too. So I can see what you're saying. Like there's different levels of involvement for the different characters. And then there's also the time passing.
Right.
Okay. The name of the novel is Right After the Weather, a novel by Carol Ann Shaw, and it's published by Atria Books. Thank you, Carol, very much for speaking with me again. I've really enjoyed it.
All right. Ciao.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with the author Carol Anshaw. You can learn more about her work at carolanshaw.com, and she tweets at Carol Anshaw. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Carol Anshaw. I'm particularly grateful since, as we know from listening to the interview, she herself does not work from prompts. But when I asked her about it, she generously rallied and came up with one. As we discussed during our conversation, right after the weather does concern violence, and it includes multiple scenes of violence, Carol suggests tackling this in the coming week. Attempt to write a violent scene. Have you ever done this before? What do you find hard about it? What comes easily? How do you approach the material? Do you have to turn away, or do you find the process a natural extension of your other writing? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, lots of other podcast sites. And you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And that's where you'll find information about my book giveaway. Look for that labeled tab on the top of my homepage if you're interested in more information about my book giveaway. So, finally, if you like the show, I do ask that you please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.